It is Tuesday, March 12th, and welcome on into Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. Cherry.
Yes.
I happen to know this for a fact.
Mm-hmm.
Around 9:30 this morning, U.S. Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg was traveling from D.C. to Philadelphia on I-95. And I know this because while he was doing that, he was talking to us.
Yes, he was.
We have that conversation coming up later this segment with the Secretary of Transportation. After that, today, we're going to talk about biking.
Yeah.
We kind of have a vague infrastructure theme, transportation theme going on today.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to talk about biking trends.
Yep.
Trails, bike clubs.
Clothing.
Clothing.
Mm-hmm.
Anything you need to know.
And get some tips because you ride your bike. To work. A bike to work.
A bike.
You're
that's
a
right.
bike
it's
sharer.
Not my bike. I'm a bike sharer. I am indeed. I rode to work today. So we're going to talk all things bike with a trio of experts, and we want to hear from you. Studio2@whyy.org if you have thoughts on biking, bike safety. 888-477-9499 is the number. And then at the very end of the show today, we're going to hop off the bike. We're going to treat ourselves
some beverages.
To a little beer. And cheese.
Our own producer, Andreas
Beer and
Copes.
Cheese?
Yeah, hit the streets and got some eats and some drinks. That sounded like a fun assignment.
They never assign me something like that. I'm just saying.
Hey, look, you got to put yourself on the list.
I do. You have to advocate for yourself. First, Cherry, let's do some headlines. Start us off in the court of law.
Yes, Delaware is in the middle of a Second Amendment debate. Within the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, they had oral arguments this week here in Philadelphia. The state's assault weapons and high magazine capacity ban is at the center of a federal lawsuit. The dispute is over a package of gun reform bills that passed the Delaware Assembly back in 2022 that limit high capacity magazines. It increased the purchasing age from 18 to 21 for most firearms, and it outright banned assault weapons. The Delaware State Sportsmen's Association, Avi, they sued to block the law. They focused in on a bill that makes it illegal to sell, purchase, or possess assault-style weapons, including AK-47s and AR-15s. Now, this gun group, they lost in the district court.
Yeah.
And so they appealed to the Third Circuit. And the Delaware Attorney General, Kathy Jennings, she says she is confident that the Third Circuit is going to side with them. And if they don't, she's going to take it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah, I was reading some analysis from Law 360. It sounded like the Third Circuit judges were probably going to side with Delaware in this case. But I guess we'll have to wait and see. And then, as always, like you said, the losing side can appeal to the nine folks in Washington.
Exactly. But, you know, I will say this. New Jersey's attorney general, they filed an amicus brief because they said if the Third Circuit rules against Delaware, that ruling would have ripple effects.
It
could very well impact New Jersey's assault weapons ban. We all know that New Jersey has some of the toughest gun laws
in the country.
Yep. So, you know, folks just feel like people shouldn't have easy access to these type of high powered guns. And one of the arguments that the gun groups were unable to make is that they wouldn't be able to defend themselves with other firearms. So there are other firearms available, just not these high capacity ones. So we'll see what happens.
You talked about Delaware and New Jersey. Let's bring Pennsylvania into the mix now.
Come on, Commonwealth.
This was anticipated, but now it looks to be official. U.S. Senator Bob Casey and his Republican challenger Dave McCormick will likely be the only Senate candidates on their respective primary ballots here in Pennsylvania. If you didn't know, Bob Casey is the longtime incumbent. Dave McCormick is the GOP challenger. Interesting that there was no real competition on the GOP side. You may recall that when this was an open seat, the one that Fetterman ultimately won, very recently, there was frothy competition on both sides within both parties. Obviously, Fetterman won his primary, and then Mehmet Oz barely won his primary over Dave McCormick and others. So hedge fund CEO Dave McCormick ran once, didn't quite win the GOP primary, came very close, and now he's basically running unopposed within the party shortly thereafter, which I found interesting.
It's pretty interesting, though, because this is probably going to be a pretty expensive race, even though there's only a couple of, you know.
It will definitely
be lots of outside money already pouring in. I mean, apparently there's a Senate majority PAC that just reserved $42 million in ad money for Casey. That's according to the Washington Post. So a lot of eyes are going to be on Pennsylvania, and they want to make sure, I guess, Casey holds onto a seat. But he's been pretty non-controversial here in Pennsylvania. I haven't no scandals that I can recall. And, you know, and he's been in there for quite some time.
And is a legacy name because his dad was a big-time politician as well, former governor. Yeah, so it's not surprising, right, that Casey is going to
run again. Yeah.
The bigger surprise to me is that somewhere in some back room in the state GOP,
the McCormick is the guy.
Yeah, they picked McCormick, and no one stepped out, broke from that consensus. And I feel like we have, the Republicans have a reputation for kind of having like internal fights recently, both here in Pennsylvania and nationally. And in this case, it seems like everyone kind of settled on McCormick, and he's the guy.
He's the guy. So in April, when we have, you know, the primary.
Yeah, no real primary to speak of. Yeah. Basically, stay tuned for November.
Yeah. The primary is sounding like a snooze fest. Anyway, another big story that caught our eye. Airbnb announced Monday that the company is banning indoor security cameras to, quote, prioritize the privacy of our community. I really didn't know this, but I'm not a big Airbnb person.
You're not.
No, I know. I'm old school hotels.
Really?
I know, but
I do Airbnb all
the time. Yeah, but it's better if you have kids. It's, you know, or you're staying long time. So anyway, Airbnbs, they used to allow their hosts to use indoor security cameras in like common areas like hallways, living rooms, as long as there was a notice to the guests that the camera was there. But after getting feedback from guests and others, they're changing the policy. And let me just say that the hosts, they used to put these cameras because they wanted to make sure people weren't having these unauthorized parties and they had noise decibel
readers
in the different properties. But now all of that is going to be banned as of April 30th of this year. And all of this comes back from feedback from guests, from hosts, from lawyers looking at privacy rules. And they say, look, no more. You can still have them outside, but of course you can't have them outside if there's a jacuzzi, right? Or there's an outdoor shower to protect people's privacy. There's also you can still have like doorbell cameras and things like that, but no more indoor cameras at Airbnb properties. And I do think it's a little creepy though, to just have cameras in the living room of a place where you should have an expectation of privacy, right? If you're renting a property for a week or something, you shouldn't have to worry about, you know, your kids walking around or whatever, and there being someone kind of peeping in inside of the home.
I'm learning a lot about you this hour. One, you don't think the primary is sufficiently entertaining this year. Okay, I got that. And number two, you don't Airbnb.
No, I've done it a couple times, but I'm not a big Airbnb-er, yeah.
Let's get one more story. So you might know that March means March Madness, the big NCAA basketball.
I saw your eyes light up when you said that.
I do enjoy it. The NCAA men's and women's basketball tournaments. Those will start soon, and everyone will start filling out their brackets to predict who will win. Maybe gamble a little bit of money on that, which you can do legally now. We talked about that recently. The Inquirer, I have to give them credit, did a fun spin on this. They picked 16 high school and college mascots our region and created a bracket where you can pick your favorite mascot of a local team. They didn't put the pro teams in there. Maybe that they're considered, I guess, too beloved. I don't know. But the options in this bracket of mascots, which you can fill out online, include the Abington Friends Kangaroos.
Ooh.
Hopping right into my heart.
I like it.
The Penn Quakers. I've always liked that mascot because it contains irony. The Upper Marion Vikings. The Nazareth Academy Pandas. So there's lots of cool mascots I'd never heard of in our region, high school and college. And I went through the exercise and I picked my favorite. It did make me think about, like, you know, what makes a great mascot?
Well, I'm assuming it has to be very memorable, one that you can remember
memorable?
And can dance. That would be,
well,
you know,
can
conducive.
Put anyone in a costume,
but
and
it can
dance.
Be conducive to a cool costume where you can dance and make movements.
Yeah.
You know, but have a personality and nothing too scary, right?
Nothing too scary. Although Gritty has caught on very well, and Gritty is frightening.
endearing way.
In an endearing way. That's not a criticism. So for me, mascots, I really like a mascot that's distinctive, like you said.
Yeah.
But that also doesn't feel too random, like has some connection to the community that it's representing. So I ended up picking the University of Delaware Blue Hens.
Oh.
Because the blue hen is related to the chicken poultry industry in Delaware.
Of course.
It's just a distinctive, memorable mascot. When you see his face, I think he's called UD or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
He just sticks in your mind and it feels quirky and fun. So that's the sweet spot for me. Quirky, fun, distinctive, but with some level of meaning.
Okay.
I haven't thought deeply about this. Okay, that's fair.
But I'm going to ride with my alma mater, Temple. I'm going to go with the owls.
They were in the bracket.
Hooty hoo. I don't even know if that's the sound.
I do like Temple Owls.
Yes.
Because it relates to something about the school, which is that it was often a commuter night school. Mm-hmm. When
and they
it
were
started.
Night, yeah.
Like, night owls, yeah. So I do like something that has some sort of... It captures some essence of the place.
Mm-hmm. And it made me look up owls and realize that they're pretty cool birds.
Oh, when you got to Temple,
yeah,
you started Wikipedia-ing
owls? I was like, well, why
owls?
Would we want to be an owl? You know what I mean? Like,
I got to cough, and if you make me laugh, it's going to go off the rails.
You got to look into, why your mascot
down.
Is your mascot.
Just tone it down.
So, yeah. But anyway, cool story, Avi. Cool story. And so we're going to move on into our newsmaker.
Sure.
Today, the Secretary of Transportation, Pete Buttigieg, is in Philadelphia at the MLK Drive Bridge, touring the construction progress. And let's face it, there are hundreds of bridges in Pennsylvania in disrepair.
We caught up with the secretary this morning to talk exclusively about mascots. I'm sorry, no. We talked about bridges, Biden, Boeing, and a lot more. Take a listen.
Secretary, you were here in Philadelphia at the MLK Bridge 2 years ago to announce billions of dollars in funding for bridges, $1.6 billion for Pennsylvania, and now you're back. We have more than 500 bridges in our region that are in poor condition. What are you seeing by way of progress in getting these bridges repaired?
Well, we're in a moment now where the money is moving and the construction is increasingly underway, and that's part of why I've been looking forward to returning to the MLK Bridge after being there 2 years ago, as we were just in the earliest stages of standing up programs like the Bridge Formula Program that were created by the Biden infrastructure package. We now have about 45,000 projects around the country that have been identified for funds through this package. Some of them can be done in one construction season. Some of them are the work of a decade. But what they all have in common is getting these projects done is going to make everyday life easier in communities around the country, including in Philadelphia.
I would love to get your thoughts while we have you on public transit. You know, here in Philadelphia, our regional transit system, in terms of ridership, is operating at roughly 2/3 capacity to what it was pre-pandemic. I would love for you to speak on what are the challenges facing American public transit systems in the next 10 years and how we're going to solve those challenges.
Well, you know, public transit is vitally important for so many Americans. It's something that is helping with affordability issues, opens up new neighborhoods, a housing option. It's even part of our climate solution, but only if that transit system is operating well, is effective, is convenient, has enough frequency to take care of riders' needs. And that's where we think investment is critically important. So another feature of the Biden infrastructure plan is it's got the most federal money going to health transit systems at any time in federal history. And that's certainly the case for SEPTA, where, just to take one example out of our rail car modernization program, we're purchasing new rail cars that are going to help add frequency and improve reliability on lines that we know people count on every day. Trans has been through a lot, especially with everything that's taking place with the disruptions and changes to commuting patterns during COVID. But what hasn't changed is how important it is to so many people's daily routines, commutes, and budgets. And the other thing I think is really important to think about when it comes to transit is, even if you don't use it, you benefit from strong transit because it means less congestion on the roads.
Yeah. I do wonder, though, it does feel unsustainable moving forward. These one-time injections of funds, capital investment is great. But how do we get to a place of sustainability when these ridership systems, like I said, are seeing so many fewer passengers than they did just 5 years ago?
Well, Well, the reason these investments matter is they can make the difference between a vicious cycle and a virtuous cycle. A vicious cycle happens when you have some kind of ridership. It hits the revenue of the system. They wind up having to respond, and then you have even less ridership. But a virtuous cycle can happen too. That's where you invest in the quality and the frequency of a transit system in a way that leads more people to use it and ride it, which in turn brings more revenue, which allows there to be better service and frequency. That's really what we're trying to drive here. The other thing I would say is that it is time to reimagine some of our assumptions around transit. Some of the older hub and spoke models that served us well in the 20th century are not necessary or sufficient for the 21st, an era of micro mobility, scooters, Ubers and Lyfts and other things. It doesn't mean transit is less relevant. It's as relevant as ever. It means transit may not look the exact same. That's okay. And we are supporting and funding transit authorities that are leaning into that new reality.
Interesting.
Yeah. And I want to switch to airports and air safety. Hundreds of flights depart from Philadelphia International Airport every single day. The FAA has been understaffed, and we've heard about reports of near misses. What's the strategy for dealing with the issues within this very important agency?
Well, this week, the president released his new budget, which requests funds to add air traffic controllers. We think that's vital to maintaining and enhancing our aviation safety record. Just think about what an extraordinary fact it is that flying on an airline in America is by far the safest way to travel. It's an extraordinary thing to contemplate for a form of travel that involves being propelled at nearly the speed of sound through the sky by flammable liquids. And we don't take for granted for 1 second what it takes to keep that up. That means that industry has to do part. It's why we're applying an extreme amount of scrutiny to Boeing right now after some of the manufacturing issues. Airlines do their part with flight crews, pilots, and maintenance. And the government needs to do our part with an adequately resourced FAA. And it means making sure there is the equipment and technology that they need as well. The president's budget will help meet that goal. We're hoping that Congress can find some bipartisan reasons to support that, because it really shouldn't be a partisan issue. The American economy and the safety of the traveling public calls for us to make these investments.
You touched on it there, but what is your message to the American people about the safety of plane travel as we read these, you know, dire headlines about quality control at Boeing, the 737 MAX? How do you convince people that it is safe to fly?
Well, again, flying on an American airliner is dramatically safer than any other form of transportation in the United States. So much so that where in the past we used to approach aviation safety by looking at the most recent fatal crash and learning from it, what we do now instead is look at the most recent close call in the absence of crashes and learn from those close calls. That's how we're continually raising the bar and making sure that we maintain the aviation safety record that we have in the U.S. But what we simultaneously need to do is take that same level of rigor, take that same level of focus, and bring it to roadway safety, where America loses about as many people as a full 737 every single day, and yet it gets very little attention. That's why we're making investments on things like Roosevelt Boulevard in Philadelphia, which is a high crash corridor, and other things across the roadway network. So whether we're talking about roadway safety, rail safety, or aviation safety, we're going to continue seeking to raise the bar and enlist every level of industry and every level of government to cooperate with us in getting that done.
Speaking of road safety, what is the number one thing we can do today in a city like Philadelphia to reduce traffic fatalities? If you could just pick one, would it be cameras? Would it be traffic calming? What do you see as the biggest mover in that space?
Well, we know that roadway design is a big part of it. That's why we're investing in Roosevelt Boulevard, Broad Street, and other areas where there have been a number of crashes. But the truth is there is no one single silver bullet. Our roadway safety strategy has five major areas: safer roads, safer speeds, safer vehicles, safer people, drivers and pedestrians and passengers too, and a higher standard of post-crash care. We really need to press on all of those simultaneously in order to get results. We're finally seeing indications that we have begun to reverse the rise in roadway deaths, about a 1% reduction last year, which doesn't sound like a lot, and it's not enough. But even that 1% reduction represents about 400 lives saved compared to the year before. We really need to pay much more attention to this as a country. I think we're so used to it that we've come to accept it, but these roadway deaths are preventable, and the only truly acceptable number of roadway deaths is zero.
Yeah, and Secretary, Pennsylvania, I'm going to pivot a little bit, because Pennsylvania is critical to a Democratic win in November's presidential election. Polls have shown repeatedly a dead heat between President Biden and former President Trump. What, in your mind, is the strategy for convincing Pennsylvania voters to choose Biden for a second term?
Well, because I'm speaking as secretary, I can't say anything about campaigns or elections. But what I can say is that this is an administration that is proud of how we are delivering in communities across the country, and certainly across Philadelphia and across Pennsylvania. We're talking about red, blue, and purple parts of the Commonwealth that have seen enormous benefits in what has happened with improvements to roads and bridges, airports, trains, transit, and more. And also a real focus on the affordability of everyday life. You know, President Biden laid out a clear contrast between his vision and congressional Republicans when he was in the House delivering his State of the Union last week. I was there as he talked about a fairer tax code, talked about what it would mean if he gets his way and we make insulin $35 a month for every American, not just for seniors, what it means to make sure that we keep cutting junk fees like what credit cards and hotels and airlines are charging people, an economic agenda that most Americans already agree with, but that he's calling for Capitol Hill to support him and actually delivering.
Well, thank you so much for the time, Secretary, and we hope you enjoy your time in Philadelphia.
I always do. I'm really looking forward to today. Thanks very much.
And it is a beautiful day indeed here in the Delaware Valley, which means it's a great time to think about getting that bike out of your basement.
Pumping up those tires.
Back onto the road. Mm-hmm. So stick with us after the break. We're going to talk all things bicycle. We're going to talk about safety. We're going to talk about trends. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about getting over the fear that sometimes keeps us from embracing cycling as a day-to-day pursuit. That's all coming up on Studio 2 right here on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Avi, we are public radio. And many of our colleagues, like yourself, they bike to work. And it is kind of like a public radio cliche, but it's very good for the environment and a great workout, right?
I'm just happy to know I'm a cliche. Thank you for that intro, Cherry. Bikes have been around for a long, long time, but there are still new trends emerging. How about those e-bikes, for instance, which are suddenly everywhere? E-bike sales have quadrupled since the pandemic. That raises some new safety concerns, which are mixing with those old safety concerns about bicyclists, cars, and how we design our roads.
And we cannot forget, the countdown is on for the Philly Bike Expo. So what better time than to bring in a panel of bike aficionados to our Studio 2 roundtable to talk about infrastructure, safety, bike trends, and a whole lot more. And with us are Ajua Abrokwa, bicycle instructor and founder of She Is Focus. We have Corey Hannigan, active transportation program manager at Tri-State Transportation Campaign, and Zachary Rochelle, owner of Keystone Bicycle Company and member of the Philly Bike Expo team. Everybody, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having us.
We're really excited to talk to all of you, but we also want to hear from our listeners. Do you maybe ride an e-bike? Want to share your experience? Do you want to start biking? What's your favorite trail in the region? Give us a call. 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2 at WHYY.org.
And so, Corey, I want to start with you. More and more people are taking up cycling in our area, not just as a hobby, but also as a mode of transportation. Tell us about the numbers. What do the numbers look like, and what does the evidence look like as far as trends in our region over the past few years?
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing a real explosion of growth and interest in, certainly cycling, but active transportation in general. That means, you know, anything not motorized, so walking or biking. I think especially after the pandemic, people really started to realize that, you know, they need to get out into the outdoors. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the places that they're going are really nearby, you know, within a few miles of their home, especially with remote work. People are really starting to recenter their lives. And for those short trips, really, cycling has become the ideal option. And then with new technology, with e-bikes, pedal assist, I think it's been a great way for folks who, you know, aren't really athletic or sporty to sort of get into this space. And they realize that, you know, maybe they can replace one of their cars or replace their car with, you know, this alternative mobility option.
Let's talk about e-bikes. Mm-hmm. I actually assumed they were newer than they are. E-bike technology has been around for a bit, but it just seems like the popularity has exploded. Zach, what are you hearing from customers, fellow biking enthusiasts? I mean, why have e-bikes, at least to my eye, become kind of this overnight success story?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of reasons that can contribute to why e-bikes are getting so popular. I think primarily the fact that they're becoming more affordable has been driving a lot of people to getting on e-bikes. I think the fact that a lot of people are moving into urban areas is also inspiring people to get e-bikes because it's such a great alternative to a car. It's much more efficient and, you know, per ride affordable than public transit. It also gives you a lot of freedom. One of the things that we're seeing with e-bikes is that there's kind of a conflict in the technology. There's a lot of like direct-to-consumer e-bike sales as opposed to e-bikes that you would see coming out of a bike shop from like a name that you might recognize, Trek, Specialized, anything like that. And the experience that some of the people have using these like direct-to-consumer e-bikes is they may not be maintainable, they may not totally be safe to ride, and so that's one of the big kind of conflicts that we're seeing and what our customers are kind of expressing to us.
Interesting. So you guys, I think I saw on Instagram recently, are starting to dip your toe a little bit more in the e-bike technology with your shop. I mean, explain why you made that decision and how you're hoping to maybe bridge that gap you just talked about between the bike shop experience and the direct-to-consumer experience.
Yeah, totally. So my bike shop, Keystone Bicycle Co., we're in Kensington. We're right on American Street, which is a freshly built kind of commuting corridor that takes you from, you know, Kensington and the River Wards towards Center City. So we see a lot of commuters. We recently started bringing e-bikes, primarily because the technology has finally gotten to a point where they're reliable, the user experience is much better, and once again, they've come down in price quite a lot. So the e-bikes that we're bringing in are meant to kind of capture that commuter price point, so where somebody can say, oh, it makes monetary sense for me to leave the car at home or sell the car because I'm just going to City Hall from Fishtown, and it's easy enough for me to get an e-bike. So we brought in Salsa. Salsa is a kind of a known name in the adventure cycling industry, and we brought in their e-bikes because they're ones that we know we can maintain. It's going to provide a really good value to our customers. And most importantly, it's going to be safe for them to ride consistently.
Mm. And on the issue of safety, I mean, I've read some stuff about e-bikes having battery issues, batteries catching fire, causing fires. People have died because of this. Is it user error, manufacturing defect, safety standard? What's the problem with that?
It's kind of a combination of all those things. A lot of it does come down to manufacturing. Since there's not a ton of standardization, and like I said, a lot of these direct-to-consumer, I mean, like if you're ordering from Amazon, AliExpress, those are so much more affordable than, let's say, like the Salsa that we would sell at the bike shop. But there's no standardization to them. So there's no there's not a ton of expectations for them. And so a lot of them are prone to having these issues with fires, especially after being exposed to corrosion or overcharging. So let's say a shop that sells a lot of e-bikes of all different makes and maintenance, you know, they sit out in the rain, it could definitely make them more prone to those kinds of accidents. But we are seeing with newer e-bikes, Rad Power, which is a major name in the e-bike industry, recently released a new fire-resistant battery design. So I'm really excited to kind of see how that develops and see what kind of changes that might bring to the e-bike industry.
That's really interesting. And, you know, we're talking about potentially broadening the group of people who consider biking as a day-to-day option. Ajua Abrokwa,
What do you find is the biggest challenge to getting folks on a bike, and how do you overcome that challenge and convince them that this is a safe and healthy option for them? Mm.
So thank you for your question. I think that one of the primary barriers is just access to information about what biking looks like as an adult, right? Mm. A lot of times people think, you know, bikes aren't for me. That's something that kids engage in, cycling, you know, biking. Right. As an adult, what am I supposed to do with a bike? I remember when I first told a couple of my friends that I was going to buy a bike, my friend was like, what are you going to do with that? I'm like, ride it? She's like, they're so childish. And I'm like,
childish.
That's what you think, really? However, over time, as she's seen me get up, get out, and get moving on the bike, she became interested, and then she has joined me for rides. I think that we need to communicate more in our messaging about how biking is for literally any and everyone, and there's opportunities all around for people to become engaged. If you are a interest, if you are a newer cycler or consider a beginner, you know, there are opportunities and spaces where you can go that are safe, that are welcoming, and you can engage in a great community of people who are like-minded.
And Drew, a follow up to you, because I feel like there's a difference in some ways between biking for transportation and biking for recreation, right? People who just like, they're into the cycling community, but they don't necessarily ride their bike to work. Which side do you fall in?
Yeah. I'll tell you, I'm one of those people. So I will honestly say I drive to work and I bike for recreation. Mm-hmm. However, have I challenged myself before to ride from my house to my job? Just, I wanted to see if I could do it and how it would feel. So over the summer when the roads were kind of less crowded, I felt more safe to venture out and do it. And I was really happy. I felt accomplished that I could do it. And I found a safe route to, you know, to ride to work. However, unfortunately, during the times where I have to go to work and then I have children, it's just not conducive to my lifestyle. However, when I'm able to, I ride the bike. But when I'm going to work or, you know, having to drop off kids to school, it's more conducive for me to just drive the car.
And I think that kind of goes, Corey, to the question of safety, because that part keeps a lot of people off of a bike because they don't know whether or not that it's safe to ride. I've been scared. I had a bike and had a scare. Talk about the infrastructure for safety and how you've seen that grow in Philadelphia and beyond.
Yeah, I'm really glad, you know, you mentioned infrastructure, right? Because I think a lot of the times this discourse centers around sort of personal behavior, personal responsibility. But the fact is, you know, people are starting to wake up to the fact that we've been designing our roadways for cars and no one else for a very long time. And people want to, you know, ride a bike for a short trip or walk. And there's conflicts there, right? They're trying to fit into this system that isn't really designed for them. But the good news is there has been really a lot of great research and new federal funding and state funding to redesign some of our streets and create the appropriate infrastructure, right? Protected bike lanes, wider sidewalks, continuous networks, right? That separate, you know, vulnerable road users from motorized road users. And, you know, it's really called all ages and abilities design because that's what we've been talking about, right? Anyone should be able to ride a bike. You shouldn't need to be confident and athletic to, you know, use this mode of transportation. And we are seeing a lot of really great work done by DVRPC in the Philadelphia region, you know, a growing network of shared use trails, like the Circuit Trails, which is a coalition we're part of, that builds out this sort of separated infrastructure so that people like Ajua can hopefully one day take her kids, you know, to school on a high quality, you know, protected bike lane or trail. And maybe her kids can safely ride with her, right?
Mm-hmm. So I want to read a couple comments here because this is, and you guys are not going to be surprised by the way that this has sort of broken out, but we've got on one side folks saying it's about infrastructure, the other side saying it's about biker behavior. So Justin via email says, the city needs a comprehensive network of hard infrastructure to protect the most vulnerable road users. Parking protected and hardened separated bike lanes are the only truly safe options. And then you've got Ross from South Philly saying bikers need to stop going the wrong way on one-way streets. All right, Zach, how do we sort through this?
Yeah,
I have a feeling you're going to say it's more about infrastructure than biker behavior. But look, you hear that biker behavior comment all the time in Philly, and I knew it was going to bubble up in the comments.
Absolutely, yeah.
So can you try to address that as well?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's a combination of both of those things. I think that biker behavior is heavily informed by infrastructure.
Right.
Like Ross's experience in South Philly, I've seen it all the time. It's partially because we don't really have safe streets in which we can bike.
Yeah.
So that rider, maybe they're just going a couple blocks, and maybe for them it's much safer to go the wrong way than to take Washington Avenue, for example, which has a mess of different types of bike lanes that aren't always safe for somebody to navigate all the way. And I think also it kind of just comes down to, you know, education and the culture that we built around it. I think that if we had a better infrastructure, people would be more aware of safer ways that they could ride their bike. And so I think it's all kind of like connected in that way. So I totally understand both those people's experience. I agree that having more protected bike lanes, like on Spruce and Pine, I rode on them today, they're really, really useful. And I will definitely go out of my way to use that as opposed to going the wrong way or something like that.
Let me add to that. They just added a protected bike lane in my neighborhood on 11th Street, South 11th Street. And all of a sudden, I'm obeying all the traffic rules. You know what I mean? Because I've got this protected bike lane where before when I was competing with cars, I was more like apt to bob and weave and sort of make my own way. Corey, you're raising your hand like that's, is that how you also navigate?
Well, I mean, the analogy I make with a lot of people is imagine if sidewalks were one way only.
Yeah.
Are you going to walk around the block? No, you're going to break the law and turn around and walk back, right? And so until we have a really useful network of infrastructure, you know, people are going to do what makes sense to them in that moment. And I think we have to acknowledge, like, there's humans using this system and people, you know, people are willful. People want to get where they're going.
Totally.
And, you know, just to make a clear point, we don't necessarily need a physically concrete separated protected bike lane on every single street in the region. Really, what we're looking for is the appropriate level of separation for the type of street, right? A lot of streets in Philly are very narrow. You really can't even drive that fast on them. They don't need that sort of super duper high, you know, expensive, you know, separation.
Concrete bollards.
Right. In the same way that you would need on a multi-lane arterial road. Right. Yeah. And a good rule of thumb is just, you know, would you feel safe with your child walking here? That's a good rule of thumb to check and see whether it's an appropriate amount of separation or not.
We have to take a really short break
here.
But we want to continue this conversation in just a minute. And maybe the other side of the break, we can talk a little bit more about some technology questions that we have coming in and some tips and biking specifics.
Absolutely tips.
So thanks to our panel. We've got a lot more coming up on Studio 2 talking all things bike. If you want to join the conversation, our number is 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. We will be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolf-Manera.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We want to continue our conversation about biking and the outdoors with our bike aficionado, Zachary Rochelle, owner of Keystone Bicycle Company and member of Philly Bike Expo team, Ajua Abrokwa, bicycle instructor and founder of She Is Focused, and Corey Hannigan, active transportation program manager at Tri-State Transportation Campaign.
Got a couple gear questions here. Want to get at least one of those in. This is Kinley via email who says, is there such a thing as solid tires? I love road biking, but potholes, etc., have me fixing a lot of flats. Zach, your take.
So it's a great question. I've been fixing flat tires professionally for about 10 years now, so it's something
that
comes
up.
You're the guy. I would say, you know, People ask about solid tires often. Unfortunately, it's not a great solution to that problem. They're extremely heavy, difficult to mount, and make your ride quality much worse. I would definitely just suggest going to your local bike shop and investing in a good set of puncture-resistant tires. Schwalbe Marathon's a really popular one that we see in this city. That's going to stop a lot of your punctures. And then additionally, running the appropriate tire pressure is going to prevent you from getting those pinch flats. It's a big thing in Philadelphia with glass and potholes. But if you're prepared, generally you're going to be pretty set up to avoid that.
And we have Mike on line one. He's from Lansdowne, wants to talk about helmets. We'll take a brief comment or question from you, Mike. You're on Studio 2.
Great, thanks. I just wondered if your guests would address for your audience changes in helmet fit technology and helmet fit methods that can make newer helmets more protective than older ones. If people are dusting off old bikes, they may have a very old helmet that's not as protective as it might be today.
All right, great
question, Mike. Who wants to take that one? Yeah, Zach, go ahead.
So helmet technology has changed a lot in the most recent years. There's been a concussion-reducing technology introduced to helmets called MIPS. That's pretty standard on new bike helmets. So a helmet that has MIPS is going to be more likely to protect your head in case of impact, which is really, really important. Additionally, one thing I would note for anybody who's getting into riding this season is helmets do expire over time.
Yep.
Light, heat, and dropping them a bunch of times make them way less effective. So if you're dusting off the bike for the season, maybe bring your helmet to your local bike shop, have them take a look at it, and it could be worth spending a couple bucks on getting a new one just to protect your
protect yourself. The gray matter. And speaking of that, like people who want to get into biking, what are some of the where should you start, Joey? You got into this. Where did you start? How do you plan it out? And you don't want to be one of those people driving down the wrong way getting honked at.
Right. So to get started, there's a few things. If you're already a cyclist, you know, there are a ton of clubs and organizations around the city that you can go online to find out about. You can visit your local bike shop. They always have a lot of information about different cycling clubs and different rides. If you're a cycling interest and you haven't been on a bike in a while, but you want to get started, you want to get going, the Bicycle Coalition of Greater Philadelphia, they have programming where you can become a member. You can, you know, go to like their Learn to Ride activities that they have at like Bartram's Gardens. I know they have Learn to Ride activities. You can, if you are a woman, we have Women's Focus Rides with She Is Focused that we're going to be getting started out of the Velo Joint in West Philly. Mm. If you have youth cyclists that are interested, there are high schools that are under the BCYC, Bicycle Coalition Youth Cycling Program. Your youth can get involved with cycling. There's Girls in Gear that cater to girl cyclists. If you have a young girl who wants to cycle interest or already riding bikes, she can join Girls in Gear. She is focused or Philly Focused and Fit. We have a summer camp that is available to middle and high school girls where you can come engage in cycling and you don't have to learn how to ride a bike. I mean, you don't have to know how to ride a bike. Mm. You can learn at our camp, or if you are already a cyclist, you can go ahead and we'll go out and explore the trails and have a good time. There are resources here in the city that if you are a cycling interest or if you are just kind of getting into the activity again or reconnecting with the activity, there are resources here. Tap into them. We welcome you. We want you. Mm. And there should be no barrier to engaging in the activity. So whatever you need, you'll gain access to.
I feel like it's all about finding community. Like, don't start on your own, you know?
And that is how I got started and why I'm still here, because of the community. Mm. Like, the interest brought me to the activity. The people, that's what really kept me here.
You mentioned trails. Real quick, can we get some trail recommendations from folks, like a favorite ride, a favorite trail? you have so many. Give me one.
My most favorite trail is the Schuylkill River Trail because I feel like I get a little bit of everything on that trail, and there are some cool sights, and then there's one of my most favorite coffee shops that I get to ride past when I'm there, the Tricycle Cafe along the Schuylkill River Trail. But I can do MLK, I can do Kelly Drive, and I can shoot up, you know, go through Manayunk, which is really cool. And then, you know, if I want to take the towpath up onto the trail and then head on up to Oaks, like I can do all
of that. I'm there with you.
I love it.
Real quick, Corey, Zach, any favorite trail rides that you can turn us on to?
Yeah, I would say Forbidden Drive in the Wissahickon is definitely my favorite. If you prefer more of like an off-road, it's a gravel road, but beautiful along the Wissahickon Creek. You know, you get to see the leaves changing throughout the year.
Love Forbidden
Jar. Such
a
beautiful area, and I would definitely suggest, if you want a car-free experience, it's a really good option for you.
Real quick, Corey, you got one for us?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a Jersey boy, so...
Okay, take us over the bridge.
Got to plug the DNR Canal Trail. It's like the crown jewel of New Jersey. It runs from New Brunswick all the way to Trenton and then up the Delaware River. And it's being connected to the Delaware River Heritage Trail, which is in construction right now. And that's a 60-mile loop on both sides of the Delaware that connects from Trenton all the way down to Philly Camden.
That is so cool.
Yeah.
That is so cool.
And 20 seconds, any final word, Corey?
Yeah. I know you... I mean, we talked about trails. We talked about the Bicycle Coalition Greater Philadelphia. So my org, Tri-State Transportation Campaign, we're part of, along with the Bike Coalition, we're part of this group called the Circuit Trails, and we're advocating for an 800-mile regional trail network in the Greater Philadelphia area, trying to hit 500 miles by 2025, and we're almost there. So, you know, look to get involved if you want to help.
I could
with
bike
that.
500 miles.
I know. If only.
Thank you, Corey Hannigan, for joining us. You also heard Ajua Abrokwa, bicycle instructor and founder of She Is Focused. Thank you so much for being with us today. And Zach Rochelle, worker owner at Keystone Bicycle Company and member of the Philly Bike Expo team. Check out the Philly Bike Expo. Thanks, everyone. That was fun.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
And by the way, Movers and Makers has a special program called Celebrating Cycling that will air this Thursday, March 14th at 7:30 on WHYY TV 12. Also, the Philly Bike Expo will open at the Pennsylvania Convention Center here in Philadelphia on Saturday.
And after a really long ride, some people say beer is a great recovery drink. I don't know who says that, but our producer, Andreas Copes, recently visited the annual beer fest at the German Society of Pennsylvania and learned that the perfect accompaniment to that tall, frosty draft is cheese.
Mm. With so many types of beer to choose from, whether it's fruity, malty, hoppy, light, or strong, it seems like the ways to pair them with cheese could be endless. So I turned to a friend of Studio 2, Tanaya Darlington, also known as Madame Fromage.
Well, I think actually it's a brilliant pairing because beer is effervescent, which cleanses the palate between bites of cheese. So if you have a really creamy, rich cheese like we did here today at Beer Fest, a sip of beer then refreshes the palate in a way that wine often doesn't unless it's a sparkling wine. And then also I think there are a lot of flavor notes in beers, malty notes, bitter notes, freshness, that complement cheese in really interesting ways. So I love to introduce a wine-loving crowd to beer and cheese.
And making a great match could actually be easier when you're working with beer as opposed to wine.
I think in some ways it's much more approachable.
That's Sue Miller from Bertrand Hills Farm, a dairy farm in Chester County. She also sits on the board of the Pennsylvania Cheese Guild.
Kind of instant gratification with pairings that way, whereas sometimes you have to like work a little harder to find the wine and cheese pairing that works so beautifully. But yeah, I think that's what probably a lot of people may think. But hey, get into the beer with the cheese or the cider with the cheese. There's so many flavors to explore with cheese that, you know, each weekend you could be doing something else.
And here's what Madame Fromage says makes for a good pairing.
I always say the stronger the cheese, the stronger the beer. So I like a good Belgian, like a Trappist or a Saison. We had a double bock today, which was, I thought, exquisite with the two strong cheeses. But yeah, just remember, if it's a strong cheese, go high ABV.
So beer with cheese it is. Definitely a trend to try this spring. Here's another one. High-end, non-alcoholic options. They are gaining in popularity, and no, I'm not talking about sodas. I tried a non-alcoholic spirit called the Pathfinder with the help of global brand ambassador Craig Rovensky.
It's Craig with a K. Craig.
Craig with a K. He says, for many consumers, these beverages are not a substitute for the real deal.
Lots of people that drink them still actively drink, just like you would find in Germany. Most people that drink non-alcoholic beers still actively drink a lot or all the time.
I was also able to catch up with a brewing legend at Beer Fest, Carol Stout, the nation's first female sole owner of a brewery, and I just had to ask her this one question.
And I'm asking you to pick your favorite child. What's your favorite beer?
This is really crazy. I think I have to say the Stout's Pilsner because it took me several years to really refine it. that it's very a delicate beer. Any imperfection will show up in it. It takes an extra time of lagering for stability and shelf life. And I think because it was so problematic until I thought it was perfected for the consumers, I think it's that.
So invite over your friends, pick some beers, pick some cheese, and get cozy, or as the Germans would say, gemütlich. For Studio 2, I'm your foreign correspondent, Andreas Copes.
I'm ready to drink. I'm ready to eat. Well done, Andreas. I do have to correct the record real quick.
Go ahead.
In the hour, I mentioned that the University of Delaware Blue Hen was related to the state's poultry industry. Two alum, Bernice and Ken Whistler, pointed out that's not true. It's just it's a fighting gamecock. That's the Delaware Fighting Blue Hens. I'm sorry. I still love you, Udi.
That's right. And that wraps our show. Our producers are Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes. Diana Martinez engineered today's show. And from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. See ya.